Members, we're going to get started. I apologize for getting us started late. We were trying to get some amendments put together in order, and frankly, I've had a rough 24 hours, so I have a hard time just getting out of bed this morning, getting here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dever.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, a quick comment just to brighten your day. Since this is Education Policy Committee, as you know, it's state tournament time. The girls, and I know you're all wondering, the Hayfield girls did win their game yesterday.
Congratulations.
So we're playing again Friday night. So, Mr. Chair, I won't be here for any committee meeting you have Friday night.
Mr. Chair, are there any Denver girls still playing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, unfortunately, no, there are not, but in spirit.
What did you see?
Representative. You're not the only one that was. Well, everybody understands that.
So, Representative Dever, give us a quick history, Hayfield's history in the tournament. How is this? Is it far? Is it gone, or have they gone farther than that?
Mr. Chair, back in 2000, I believe, they also made it to the state girls tournament. Unfortunately, at that time, they had the first round in regional areas throughout the state, and they lost their first game, and it was like never having played in the state tournament. So this is the first real experience that the girls have had. Like, they played at Williams Arena and got a chance to play it in the city now, so it's a lot of fun for the kids.
Good for them.
Yeah.
Good luck. Members, we're going to take up House File 3316. We've got a number of amendments on that. However, we also have House File 3793, Representative Dabney, which is our intent to take up after the 3316 amendment, or rather, bill. However, my understanding is that we've had a number of individuals that have driven quite a distance to be here for the Dabney bill, and I think they were anticipating having us hear that this morning. And so, given that we're still not at quorum yet, as opposed to diving right into the bill that we want to act on this morning, I'm going to ask those individuals who have driven that distance to come and offer their testimony for committee. And hopefully, by the time we hear from them, we can then move on with House File 3316. So, if the members from the public who have come this morning to testify on House File 3793 can come forward, I appreciate it.
Chairman Gary Bostic for Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. I've got a number of people here from out of state, out of town, and we'd prefer, since Representative Abney's not here either, it wouldn't be fair to either side not to do it all at once. So we will reload and come back at 6 o'clock tonight, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Very well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, is there a, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a possibility that we might hear that bill this morning yet?
Representative Ward, there is a possibility. We have 12 or 13 amendments last time I counted, and
right.
A number of them are technical in nature, so it's possible we can get through these.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, we'll stay.
Oh, okay, very good.
Get it done. Get it done.
Are we at quorum? Okay. Members, until we're at quorum, if someone can move the minutes from March 11th, I'd greatly appreciate it. If it says Dietrich moves the minutes from March 11th, all in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, I'm going to take House File 3316 off the table. And so the motion is for House File 3316 be recommended to pass. And we've, as I said, we've got at least 13 amendments. And the first one that we're going to take up is from Representative Erickson, because it's the lead-all amendment, Representative Erickson. So it makes sense to me that we take yours up first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the DE5 amendment.
Representative Erickson moves the DE5 amendment. Excuse me, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is what we would probably call the minority report. It is a delete-all to the delete-all, and Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call on this, please.
There's a roll call. Roll call is being called.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, members. I'll try to minimize the noise.
We'll try to do more talking today than
you,
Mr. Chair. So as you look through the DE5 amendment, you will notice that we have included much of the department language. We felt that what the department brought to us in technical changes, as well as in Article 2 of the charter school, not Article 2, but Article 1, the charter school changes were excellent changes, and we wanted to support that. In Article 2, the first five sections are department language, and in Section 6, we have shown that we prefer the definition of value added that is presently in law, and to emphasize proficiency when it comes to how we deliver a report card for our students and our parents, and also help our teachers understand. So we are making an important point about our students reaching proficiency in using the department language there. In Article 2, Section 15, we have included a Representative Dabney's bill on student cooperation. And somebody's asking me to give pages, so just a second, let me get to the page.
Page 28, I believe.
Thank you. Section 15, page 28 is the Dabney bill. As you recall, the amendment that was made in committee went from in line 29.11 from requirement to expectation. Although I do have a problem with the word expectation, it's very broad. We thought it was worthy to include Representative Dabney's bill because it does deal with student cooperation in regard to those matters. Article 2, Section 18, which is on page 30. This is our version of closing the achievement gap, which we think is more wide-reaching and is not redundant, because the language in the Mariani bill was an encouragement and we to submit plans. And we know that already schools are submitting plans, so we built on that. So that is our reason for including that language. And then Article 2, Sections 21 through 23, which begins on page 34, is an inclusion of the Bingham bills, except for a change on page 35. Instead of a school hiring authority at its discretion, we have changed the law to must request a criminal history background check. So that line, members, is on 35.19. And in the second Bingham bill on page 36, to accommodate what the Board of Teaching will need to do to get ready for this, we have changed the effective date to May 1st, 2009. We have included in Article 2, Section 24, Representative Benson's very good deletion of a mandate that we find is not needed. and Article 2, Sections 25 through 34 are department language, again, dealing with charter schools. And Article 2, Sections 35 and 36 are the department and our position on the report card instead of Representative Reinert's report. And, Mr. Chair, the rest of the bill is primarily recommendations from the Department of Education. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions if there are any.
And Representative Erickson, back on Article 2, Section 18, which was the language for my bill, does this require the plans to be filed within the school, the current school improvement plan? Is that the...
That is correct, okay. Mr. Chair.
Members, are there any other, are there any questions? If not, Representative Erickson, I'm sorry.
I think Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I guess just a comment that I would like to make is regarding the state growth norm, which is of the bill. The original bill talks about a state growth norm comparing to an average of the state as we look at kids in their testing, as opposed to looking at standards and benchmarks that we set. And I just want to reemphasize the importance, I believe, of working to a standard as opposed to always comparing to the average. The average will always, I think when we're working on averages, we will never have a high standard in place. And I just think it's really important that we do, as we set our standards, as we revise our standards, that we strive for those standards as our benchmarks, as opposed to testing against an average. So I just want to highlight that particular piece that I think is very important.
Thank you, Representative Demmer. And I'm not as well versed as Representative Reinert is, but my understanding was that those norms were tied to the state standards, and that the model that Mr. Heistad presented would have established a way to measure accelerated growth toward those norms, or rather toward those standards. I'm having a rough time this morning. Toward those standards, and that the goal there was to certainly not to eliminate the standards, because it doesn't do that. I mean, that's still an expectation, but that we'd be able to identify activity, progress that's happening with a student that's in an accelerated nature, and that all is tied to hitting those standards. At least that's my understanding of how that works, but I certainly understand your desire to keep us focused on making sure that we're hitting standards. I think that's a goal that all of us share in common, and we might have a slight different interpretation of how that model in particular gets us to that. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I myself am really excited about the Representative Reinert's version of the report card. I wouldn't be if it didn't also include the information that we have on the report card now. I think it's a service to parents to actually have both. You know, every now and then, when I was going to school, I had a teacher where maybe only one person got an A and almost everybody got a D or an F. And, you know, to not know if everybody is failing compared to one measure, but then to not know what the average is in terms of making progress, I don't think you have all the information that you need if you're going to be evaluating how your kids are doing. The legislative auditor has told us that by 2014, on a conservative measure, 80% plus of schools will be not making adequate yearly progress. So that won't tell us anything then if every single school district comes out with a bad grade by that point. But this this report card, which would be a second measure, not displacing, would give parents the idea to know how their kids are doing compared to the statewide average. And I think that's just essential, because the further we go along with this No Child Left Behind, unless we get rescued with it, the less information the current report card is going to provide.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Mary Ann. May I ask the department to come forth and just talk briefly about the report card as it the language as it is stated in our version?
if they can do so briefly, I would welcome that. Anyone from the department wish to come forward? Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, they're coming down very quickly. And I don't disagree with Representative Greiling and her interpretation of that. I think it is good to compare how we're doing. You know, we all, as parents, we all are doing, well, my kid's doing okay, but how does it compare to other kids? I understand that. I just think we have to make sure our focus is not always against ourselves. The focus still has to be on how we're doing against those standards. The standards are being revised and updated by people who do set high expectations for our kids based on what they should know and not based on what the other kids are doing. And it's about a reference point. The reference point not being against averages, but I think we have to keep our focus on the reference point being excellence and achievement of certain goals. And that's, it's good to know against averages, but we have to keep our focus that we want the kids to know what we've established to be standards and benchmarks for their education.
Welcome.
Thank you. Assistant Commissioner Christy Hovannis-Blaswell from the Minnesota Department of Education. To speak to both points, the proposal that's in the current amendment demonstrates a link explicitly to the standards. In Dr. Heistad's model, you can overlay growth onto the standards, but it's not a goal towards the standards. So the two are not explicitly linked in the model. With regard to knowing how students do compared to the rest of the students in the state, on the individual student report card that goes home to the parents, there is information on individual student growth as well as what their percentile rank is within the state of Minnesota. And that comes out directly to parents and provides more information to them specifically on their individual student's performance. But with regard to schools, our expectation that schools can get all students to meet that proficient mark or meet the standards as had been set by the Minnesota educators previously.
Thank you. Any further comments, questions? If not, a roll call has been called on the DE5 amendment. The clerk will take the roll.
Abler. Benson.
No.
Brown.
No.
Dabney.
No.
Demmer.
Yes.
Detmer.
Yes.
Dietrich.
No.
Erickson.
Yes.
Scott Walt.
Yes.
Riley.
No.
Hydrogen.
Yes.
Hornstein. Hornstein is absent. Haas. Haas is absent. Lane. Lane is absent. Nornis?
Yes.
Peterson?
No.
Slawick?
No.
Slocum?
No.
Swales is absent. Tilbury?
No.
Erdahl?
No.
Ward?
No.
Wardlow?
Yes.
Welty?
No.
Abler?
On behalf of the team here.
Mariani.
No. I don't feel like I'm here anyway.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that one of my colleagues voted no because his bill wasn't included, and we like Representative Erdahl's bill, but we had to send forth a bill that has no cost to it. So if you noticed in any place where we had an appropriation, it was if funds were available. So I apologize. Dean Erdahl was not at our meeting this morning, and so I didn't get a chance to tell him that we were sticking very strictly to our not sending forth anything that would need a fiscal note in this bill or this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. A vote of 8 ayes and 13 noes, the DE5 amendment does not prevail. Next amendment is the A18 amendment. And that's my amendment, and I'll move the A18 amendment. Members, these are primarily technical corrections. There's some language here regarding charter school language. This is all the corrected language. This is a blind.
We're so better at that right now.
Well, these are just corrections to the state when we last amended the bill. So discussions, members? If not, all in favor of the A18 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Next is the A5 amendment, Representative Garley.
All right, Mr. Chair, I would move the A5 amendment.
Mr. Garley moves the A5 amendment.
And Mr. Chair and members, this is an amendment to the Winkler bill, the technology bill, where they were trying to have enforced guidelines, and I think this committee made it pretty clear. If it's going to be enforced, we want it to be real rules promulgated with public process, and this would do that.
So, Representative Graven, you have language on the Winkler Amendment. You have the Special Ed Task Force language.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I forgot about that part. Maybe Ms. Larson can go through that.
Why don't we do that? Ms. Larson, please.
Mr. Chairman, members, the A5 amendment addresses expedited rulemaking in two contexts, both for technology standards as well as for the special education rule. The second part of this amendment is an amendment to Representative Hilstrom's Special Education Task Force bill. It addresses the issue of the aversive and deprivation statute and rule and provides for expedited rulemaking to conform language to what the federal law reauthorized in 2004 requires.
And Mr. Chair, in addition to the task force addressing this, because this is, the members on this committee may hear from advocates who like the rule that the commissioner had been promulgating, and I have talked with Sue Abderholden, who's the executive director of National Alliance on Mental Illness. She is convening a task force this summer that will include the intermediate school districts and others, and anyone in this room who's interested in it might want to contact her as well to also address this issue and provide input to the task force or maybe to the legislature. So it will be addressed for those who will be unhappy that that rule is not going forward, but I think we do need to take a breath from it because it was school districts were having quite a problem with that rulemaking going forward.
Well, Representative Riley, I don't think we need to pause the department forward, but my understanding is that they are fine with this language, and it actually results from a series of conversations they've had with you and other members.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That's my understanding.
Very well. Any questions? Anyone wish to comment on the amendment? Ms. Schwab.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Grade 12 with Minnesota School Boards Association. I want to draw your attention to line 17. I serve on the Special Education Task Force, so I was served on the first initial, and I'm guessing I'll have that role in the second one. And you actually have a task force that's the balance between advocates and school employees, and it sort of goes back and forth. And I am the mission you gave us is relatively a negative mission. It basically says what shouldn't be in law and tell us why. And unfortunately, that leads, I believe, to conflict. And I think adding adverse and deprivation procedures into this is going to make it even tougher. You know, if I had my will of the world, I would say something like, task force should be considering what to say and why, and support it with why it should be important to Minnesota. And it's inherent nature. It is a very emotional, divisive issue. And I'm very concerned about attacking this. I don't think we'll come out with relatively good information to share back with you. So I just have some concerns on 1.7, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schwab. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Ms. Schwab's concerns, and I'm hoping, though, that the task force, with the new tools that Representative Hilstrom has in her updated bill, so that it's not just keeping the federal standard or going all the way to the state standard, but instead having something in between, will help this task force to work more collaboratively. And then also this group that I mentioned informally working, I think will be able to provide hopefully some agreed upon good information to the task force that may also expedite this task.
Any further discussion? If not, Representative Grayling moves to the A5 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
No.
Motion prevails. The next amendment is the A1 amendment. Representative Wallach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm bringing forward this amendment as part of a Winkler bill. He carries our ABE funding in the Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee. What this says, this is actually an agreed-upon change. Most of the language went into your bill before this. They thought that this had a fiscal note, so this piece had been kept out, but it does not have a fiscal note on line 1.23 and 1.24. In terms of the way you calculate ABE, the average growth in state total contact hours over the prior 10 program years. So, Mr. Chair, this has been agreed on by the department and everybody, and there is no cost to it. So I urge the members to support it.
Very well. Any discussion on the A1 amendment? Anyone wishing to testify on it? If not, Representative Pollock moves the A1 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Next is the A14 amendment. Representative Wardwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A14 amendment. And I do have a very short amendment to the amendment. I want to cross out two words.
Very well.
An oral amendment. If you look on the third page, line 3.2, I want to cross off the words, or strike the words good cause. That makes it consistent with the rest of the bill.
For good cause, perhaps, Representative Wardwell?
For good cause, I'm sorry. For good cause.
Representative Wardwell, we'll incorporate that into your amendment.
Thank you. This amendment was brought to me by a Rosemont principal, Tom Istrup, and his social worker, Susan Peepgrass, and they are in the audience behind me if you need to ask them questions. But what they were finding was that it regards absenteeism and children who have 7 days of unexcused absence from school. They're required to go into the family and find out why, and to avoid some sort of intrusion from county authorities, the way the law states, they could just pull their kids out of school and avoid that. And that did happen on occasion. They had one family that had a couple other siblings who had missed 50% of the school, and they couldn't do anything about it. But then I started getting lots of phone calls and lots of emails from different folks, and they were concerned about parental rights regarding taking their children out of school when they want to, rather than being forced to keep them in. And so I made some phone calls. I talked to Mike Donnelly from HSDLA, and I talked to John Tuma, who lobbies for the homeschool people, and we got some kumbaya, and I talked to Representative Peterson about it and told her what had happened. This all transpired like between 4 and 6 last night. And Mr. Tuma came to me and said, this is a good bill. Lisa Larson, I gave her 2 marathon bars to make sure that she got nourishment to continue on. And everybody's had, I showed the bill to Principal Itstrom and Susan Peepgrass, and I showed it to John Tuma, and everybody's happy with this bill. They both think both sides are happy with this now, so I'll stand for questions. They can answer for me if they wish. It's a kumbaya deal, okay? Let me convince you.
Representative Peterson.
just very quickly, I think it's a good bill, and I was involved with this also, and it does deal with this issue of truancy and the need for having students in school once in the first grade. Now, obviously, kindergarten is permissive, but in first grade, we need them there. And it deals with child protection, all of the issues around keeping our kids safe, and also certainly deals with the achievement gap, which all of us are trying to deal with. So it's a good bill.
Members, any questions, thoughts? Anyone in the audience wish to comment on the amendment?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question. You know, in line 2.31 and page 2, it we're referring to this not applying to a kindergarten under age 7, and up in 2.16, we're changing it to first grade. Is that an issue? Did I miss something?
Representative Wardlaw?
Say those lines again.
On line 2.16, we're changing it to apply to kids in first grade or higher. And then down in 2.31, we're saying the subdivision does not apply to a kindergartner under age 7.
That's correct. It's just consistency.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Demmer, the reason for doing it that way is that if we left it without that clause, the law would remain silent on this particular circumstance. So it's simply to clarify what happens to a kindergartner. Yes, you're correct, it does apply to first grade, but without explaining what happens in alternative circumstances not described here, it would be silent and unknown. Okay. And that's simply a clarification of the intent.
Any further comments? If not, Representative Wardlaw moves the A14 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Also prevail. Representative Slawick, the A4 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment was brought to me in our early childhood committee. We have the community education folks, and Ms. Bilsland also worked on this. Right now, current law requires community education programs to submit an annual report to the Department of Education, and in that report, you can see the language is crossed off. They're required to include the cost per participant and the cost per contact hour for each community education program. Well, what this amendment does, it takes out that requirement to include the cost per participant and the cost per contact hour, but still requires a report to be submitted. The change is agreed to by the Department of Education, and they support it. It's needed because data collected from across the state varies widely, and it's not consistent in terms of cost, and it's unclear to community education directors how exactly to fill out this report. So, Mr. Chair and members, I hope you will support this amendment.
Discussion on the A4 amendment, Representative Erskine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Slawick, why would complete a program report be a better option than the specifics that are included in the deleted language?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, well, what's happening now is when you do this cost per participant and cost per contact hour, it's causing some confusion out there. And we all know we could go around this table, everybody has different community ed department and how they do their paperwork. And the way the state is set up is we prefer local control, but then when you're trying to fill out common forms under local control, sometimes that can be quite a challenge. So the Department of Ed has agreed to this, and again, it would allow, by doing a program report, that they can, it's not going to require that type of breakout, and they can fill it out with more discretion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A follow-up, Representative Slawick. So a program report, would that also include what the results are in regard to each of the community ed courses or some of them that may be offered? Because my concern with community ed is always that there's a wonderful potpourri of programs offered through community education, but I'm never sure that there's been a benefit of that program to either the community or to the school or to the parents or to whomever participates. So, I still think a program report is probably okay, listening to your argument. However, I still think it's rather vague.
Sir, I'd like to ask Ms. Sosland to comment on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Sosland. I'm with the Minnesota Community Education Association. First of all, I'd like to thank the department for their effort to work on this language. They had several meetings with the Community Education Association the last month about this language. My understanding is that if this should pass, the Community Ed Association is working with the department to come up with a program report which will include financial information and other program information. Maybe the department might be able to add some other information. The reason why the cost per participant and cost per contact hour is challenging is all of you have received your community ed catalogs in the mail several times a year, and there's a lot of different classes and course offerings that are offered all the way from after-school enrichment to adult basic education to adult enrichment programs, and it's just very hard for community ed directors to know exactly how to provide information in that report, and the information that they are giving is not consistent across school districts. So what White Bear Lake might be reporting might be different than what Raynard is reporting. So we are trying to work with the department to provide some more consistent and usable information in that report. And in regards to Representative Erickson's question, I'll have to get back to you on some more information on that, but I think one of my thoughts is we provide information on results and accountability into the areas of adult basic education and ECFE and school readiness. And I'm happy to provide you some other information in regards to the other programs like after-school enrichment and community adult enrichment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Sosland, presently the report that's described here that is being deleted does also include the results of ABE and early childhood. So there is an accountability built into the report presently?
I don't know the answer to that question. I know that in the areas of early childhood, family education, and school readiness, they are also required to submit separate reports, which I believe includes some outcomes data. But I'd have to get back to you on that.
Thank you.
Thank you. My question on this, is this going to be more work for a community ed director?
Our intent is not that it create more work, but our intent is that it creates a much more usable document for the department and for community ed programs across the state. Right now, the challenge is it's difficult for community ed directors to know exactly how to report the information on the cost per contact hour. I mean, there's just so many course offerings offered by a community ed program that it's difficult for them to figure out exactly how to report that information. So the intent is to streamline the report and make it easier for community ed programs and make the report usable for both community education and the department.
Representative Harger. Being a former community ed director, I know that I had to always report to school boards and go over the budget and everything else, so I'm already doing that for the individual school districts. Just looking at this, I think what you're trying to do is get all community ed in compliance if they're all doing the reports the same. Is this the intent? Okay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Ms. Sosland answered a lot of my question. My concern is what is the program and what is the report going to contain, and it sounds like they're working on that, and that makes sense. And the other question I would have had is, how is the department using this information that they're getting from Trinity Ed, and is it something that they find useful and are using? And I guess that's kind of answered by her saying that they're working with the department to come up with a report that's both usable and makes sense. So I'm satisfied. I think that was just my question. It's nice that we don't have to say that they're going to do this, to just have them do it.
Any further questions, comments? Then, if not, Representative Slawick moves the... which one is it?
A4
amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Next is the A17 amendment. That's my amendment. I'll move that amendment. Members, this reinstates the Committee on American Indian Education of the Department of Education. We heard this in Representative Clark's bill. However, the difference here is that we're making the language permissive in terms of the committee being reimbursed for expenses. by the commissioner. One of the issues with the previous language, obviously, had to do with creating more costs for the department in regards to this matter. I think it's really important that the that the department maintain this committee. My understanding is there's been some kind of a presence in the form of a committee for a long time at the department. And I think it's borne out to be a mutually helpful relationship between our American Indian communities and the Department of Education. So members, that's my amendment. Any questions for the server?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there not a cost to this?
Representative Erickson, my belief is that there would not be. We're making the language permissive in terms of reimbursing the cost of the committee.
I see. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just read line 1.12. That answers my question. Thank you.
Any further Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just wondering if the department would comment on this.
Anyone from the department here with the comment? Morning, Ms. Weber.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michelle Weber. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. There is an American Indian task force that the department has been working with over the last year, and the commissioner is committed to continuing work with the tribal programs in Minnesota.
Any further questions or comments? Yes. Mr.
Weber. So, Ms. Weber, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Weber, would this then be an additional cost to the department?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I would be hesitant to comment on that without doing a fiscal note and working with the people in the agency who work specifically with the task force. However, the word may is permissive on the reimbursement of costs. It's always supported when we have funds to be able to pay for travel, meeting expenses, etc.
Further comments or questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was trying to find this in the document. This, does this exclude then the continuing education credits for teachers?
Representative Peterson, this is not part of this amendment. That was in the Representative Clark's bill.
And this is this, Mr. Chair. This is a different. This is a different.
There were Representative Peterson. There were several components to the Clark bill.
Right.
This one only deals with the committee, American Indian Committee.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, where's the rest of the Clark bill? Okay. Mr. Chair, I'll find out later. Thank you.
We referred that to Representative Bradley's committee last week. A little slow on the uptake this morning, Representative Peterson. Any further comments? If not, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Next is Representative Flawick, the AOA 1367 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was brought to me from Representative Bly, who I think is in the room. He was in the room before. Hopefully he's still around beside. He tells me that he needs this amendment to comply with a wind energy conversion system that's happening in his district, and that they have requested this language. As you can see what it is, it's an authority issue, and I have to say, Mr. Chair, I'm not as we might want to have him come down and explain it, but I think it really is legislation and language that's been requested by his district.
Representative Black.
Okay.
Welcome. To explain your amendment, please.
Yes. I was contacted last week by a couple of district actually superintendents that some time ago, one of them happens to be
superintendent from Representative Morrow's district as well. But they entered into a partnership with 14 districts to and an LLC to purchase wind turbines on Buffalo Ridge. And some, I'm not sure how this happened, but someone had asked for an attorney general's opinion about whether or not it was okay for them to do this. And the attorney general said, well, there's nothing in statute that allows this to happen. So they contacted me and said, well, let's have something in statute so we can do what we proposed to do. There's been some conversation about whether or not districts should get a wind provider tax benefit, and this actually doesn't deal with that issue at all, because these turbines are not in the school district itself. They would gain some from the profit, if there was profit, from the production of wind energy, but not from any tax credit. So it's really simply to put in law that the partnership can happen, and that they can have part ownership with other districts and this LLC to produce energy.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Demmer and Representative Gladley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if Representative Bly can answer this. That is in the nature of my question, wind energy production tax. Will these windmills pay the wind energy
yes,
production tax?
Yes, they will.
And so that will go in the jurisdiction that they're residing in.
Yes.
And the next question I have is, you said there could be profits from these. What will happen to those profits that go to the school districts? Will that be offset then against the general education revenue from the state as the production energy tax?
No, I don't have the answer to that question. I'm sorry. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair, Ripton, by that may have been sort of my question. I was wondering, so if the school district is actually jointly owning these along with other, like the city, or what's the point of school districts being in this? And it's for their own energy purposes?
Chair Mariani and Representative Dreiling, this is not for their own energy use, because the turbines are in a different location. They're on Buffalo Ridge. So, but they've entered into this partnership in part because, from what I understand, these districts favor green energy as opposed to traditional energy, and also believe that there would be some monetary benefit, some profit from the selling of the energy. But no, it's not. These are not within the district. The turbines would not be in the district they are in a different location. It's a different, you know, there was a provision in law, I believe it was my predecessor who brought forward to say that a school district could own a wind turbine and put it up in their own district. This is different from that. This is a different plan.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wish I had more information about this. I mean, how do school districts have the money, with as strapped as they are, to be making these sort of investments, I guess is my biggest question.
I don't think it's necessarily they have to put up money, but to become a partner in the loan or usually you have to make an investment or borrow money from an investor who will help you with the project, and I don't think the district necessarily. They may be taking on some liability, that's true, but I don't think necessarily they have the money that they are investing up front. But they are partners in production. In fact, I should probably know more about the agreement than I do, but as I said, the goal of this amendment is to make possible this partnership. There's already in statute a law that says districts can own a wind turbine. It says that they can own it in partnership with other districts.
Sure, I guess I'd like to hear from Mr. Deans before I think of
Well, do we have him come up, and I think you had something on this point, Representative Demmer, is that correct?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to comment on the location of the wind turbine really doesn't matter, because anybody that has these wind turbines, the energy always feeds back into the grid, and you never get it directly from the turbine itself. So whether it's located on the ridge or whether it's located on your own property, it doesn't really matter. I think the piece of policy, Mr. Chair and members, that we have to be thinking about here is the benefits of that wind turbine. And we're talking specifically about a school district that would own a wind turbine and get benefit from it. And this is not in from their investment or whatever they do in getting benefit. And this is not unlike what we talked about on the floor the other day with wind production energy tax, where there it was deemed that that tax should be spread and that benefit should be spread to all school districts under the guise that that one school district shouldn't benefit just because it happens to have wind. Well, in this case, we're talking about the school district benefiting just because it happens to be part of something that owns a wind turbine. So I think from a policy standpoint, we have to decide, Mr. Chair, are we going to allow school districts and or people investing in turbines to get the benefit of their investment for their area, or are we going to spread these benefits statewide? And I think we have to be consistent in that policy.
Representative Blunt.
Chair Mariani and Representative Emery, I think there's a slight difference in that the school district does, you know, there could be some risk there to accepting that and in the ownership process. So there's a little difference in just benefiting from a wind turbine that might be producing energy in your district and getting that tax. A slight difference.
Well, and Representative Blight, you hit exactly on my point, exactly. Because the risk being borne by the people who only think privately is by people living in that district. They have capital at risk. You said the school district may not even have money invested. Wind energy turbines that are put up by individuals within a district personally have cash invested. It's their personal investment in this. And the benefit from that is we've decided on the House floor that the benefits of that should be spread throughout the district, throughout the state, as opposed to within the district where the people living there have made that investment. You made my point precisely, Representative Blythe, and the risk is with the people living in the area. The benefit should be in the area.
Oh, I see.
We'll hear from
Chair Mariani and Representative Demmer. I thought we were in disagreement. I'm inclined to be in agreement.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tom Deans. I'm Lakes Council of the School Board Association. I'm also counsel to this joint powers entity. There's 14 school districts in this first group that have gotten an allocation from the federal government to be able to issue what are called clean renewable energy bonds, and those are tax credit bonds. You don't they don't pay. There's no interest portion of them. The people that purchase them get a tax credit for doing that, and that's how you get entities to buy these. And it's kind of a complicated financing mechanism. But one of the problems with the clean renewable energy bonds is they've got payback provisions in them that make it so that you can't actually make these things cash flow the way that you need to. You have to make a payment within the first year after you issue the bonds. And the problem is there's about a 12 to 16 month period to wait to get these turbines, because they're so backed up because everybody around the country is building wind turbines now. So it doesn't work. What they want to do is enter into as part of their agreement, enter into it with a limited liability company or a corporation as part of a partnership. They would get the tax credits for this, and at the end of the time, the school districts would get the turbines at the very end. They would also get any share of the profits that did not go to repayment of the bond, of the principal on the bond.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Deanston, how do you view this legislation? I mean, you think this is absolutely necessary, right, to get this in?
Mr. Chairman, this is necessary. The deal does not work without this. That's why we had said we didn't think there was authority for them to enter into this sort of a partnership with a limited liability corporation. The Attorney General, they sent it to the AG. The AG said that was correct. They don't, and this would give them that authority, and then these projects will be able to go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, Mr. Dean, if you're representing the Limited Liability Corporation, and now with your school board hat on, I guess I have you to try to separate your legal hat. If this were the Environment Committee, I would vote for this right off the bat, and I I want to vote for it, but I just want to make sure that, that there's not any, this is the Education Committee then, that this is a good deal for schools, including their wanting to be environmental, but financially it's also a good deal for schools. And I will vote for it if no one in this room tells me that's not the case.
Mr. Chairman, I know that there have been studies that have been done for this entity that, that shows how this would work, what the returns would be, that the cash flow will be there if they can get the things built. It's a cash flow problem at the front end that doesn't allow these things to get built. They've looked at this over a period of 2 years. I mean, they're convinced that this is a good program and it should be able to go forward. And I believe there's another one behind it that's also gotten authority from the federal government to do this.
Representative Riley, I'll do what the committee's desires here, but I'm wondering whether this discussion might not be a better discussion in your finance committee.
Mr. Chair, I think so.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Bly, I'm a private landowner, a farmer, and I have my own wind turbine for my own use. Does this apply to that person?
No, no.
It doesn't. Okay, thank you.
Representative Welty, and then Representative Pollard.
Just quickly, Mr. Chair and the testifier, is this the Johnson Control program that they have been going around to area districts and trying to get them to buy into? I'm just getting clarification.
Yes, indeed.
Mr. Chairman, Johnson Controls is involved in this first one.
Okay, thank you. That's all I need.
Representative Flowers.
Chair Mariani, I think after discussion and Representative Bly, I think the best thing to do at this point is we should withdraw this amendment and look at putting it on in Education Finance. I think Chair Greiling would like to take a more thorough look at it. I think that's the best path for this amendment. So I will draw the 1368 amendment.
Very well. Excuse me. Representative Devon?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Boggs, I agree. I think that's good. This is a good discussion, and we need to have it, but it's really relating to money. And if we could, Representative Bly, I would like somebody's opinion on the profits from this going to schools. And will that be offset, as we are proposing to do now with the wind energy production tax? I think we need some consistency. Quite frankly, I support what you're doing here. I want to make clear about that's the other thing. But I just want to make sure we're clear on publicly owned turbines as we are with privately owned turbines and have a consistent policy. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Demmer. Representative Swalick withdraws the 1367 amendment. Excuse me, next amendment is A16. That's my amendment.
Great amendment,
which we withdrew. The A16 amendment, members, as you know, Representative Riley had a subcommittee working on the integration rule and revenue related to the rule this year. This was a small step toward trying to get at some of the issues related to integration revenue. The amendment would require that school districts that are participating receiving the revenue clearly publish what their DSAG integration goals are, that in so doing so with the department that they identify what measures they're going to use to measure progress toward those goals, and then demonstrate to the department that, in fact, they're making progress toward those goals. It's a small step toward trying to get a better handle on what's currently being done with integration revenue in the state. As many members know, the rule itself is pretty broad, and without passing judgment at this point on whether or not elements of those rules are things that we should or shouldn't be doing, I thought it'd be wise to ask the districts themselves to tell us what they're doing within that broad mandate and give us ways in which they're identifying their progress toward that. So perhaps in the coming session, we can revisit this issue in a way that's helpful both to districts, but it's also consistent with what we want to do as a legislature in terms of our priorities for these funds. So that's basically it. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am glad that we're doing a little crumb with the whole task force that Representative Heidgerken and I spent some time on. I know that both he and I are interested in major reform of the funding of the desegregation revenue. This is not a good year to be adding $30 million to this funding, but that's what it would take to make fair funding around the state. We have the, we all remember the glaring issue of Stillwater getting a lot more money than Brooklyn Center. And so we definitely need to revisit this, and it's my intention to make it a big issue next year. And I liked all the auditor's recommendations, and this is really none of them. And so I'm going to vote for this amendment, but I just want to let everybody in the room know that next year, perhaps Representative Filstrom, I haven't asked her, but I'm going to, who represents Brooklyn Center, will want to chair this, and we'll actually get somewhere.
And Representative Browning, again, my intention here is knowing and sensing the sort of growing will in the legislature to address this issue again. My desire here was to give an opportunity for those districts that are currently staked and involved in this to be able to provide us with further information about the value of this revenue used, so that can be part of the mix when we deliberate this next year. Representative Heidgerken and Representative Erickson.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Again, we did have some meetings this summer on that. Representative Browning is correct, and Representative Brown and I think have about the same issue, because she's got Albert Lee and I've got Melrose, where Melrose has, and I think Albert Lee likewise, are at around 18%, so they don't hit the trigger point of 20%, where I think within Albert Lee and Melrose has got probably a couple hundred students that are protected students, and they're not getting any of the monies. And we've got school districts in the state of Minnesota that only have 3 children are getting monies. But it's just the way it's all set up. It's, it has adjoining districts. It has voluntary districts. It has many different funding mechanisms that trigger this, but we need to be fair across the board with it. And I think Representative Faust brought that out yesterday in committee, but it's something we need to look at more carefully as we go along. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like this accountability approach very much, and in, you know, looking at what's presently in law, we really do not have anything presently that addresses this. But will the districts consider this an unfunded mandate?
Representative Erickson, I can't speak for the districts. We're certainly asking them to provide more information than what they're currently providing. There is some language in either in statute or in the rule that requires information to come forward to the department, and the department therefore to forward that information to us, and that has not happened traditionally in the past. And so this is sort of a way to also re-kickstart that accountability flow.
Mr. Chair, could we hear from the department on
this? Is anyone here from the department who wishes to comment?
And I guess my question would be, what presently happens to hold the dissemination of this, or the distribution of these dollars to these schools? Because I too agree with the legislative auditor's report, and like Representative Greiling, I think all the changes are necessary, but I'm just wondering what's expected now, and is it...
I don't see anyone jumping to testify.
Maybe I asked a hard question.
Assistant Commissioner.
Good morning. Kaz Anderson, Deputy Education Commissioner. Looking at this amendment, it appears that meeting 1, 2, and 3 is a condition of receiving revenue, the aid and levy that's part of the program. So in that case, we would probably spend quite a bit of time reviewing the applications, because there's some consequences to not meeting 1, 2, and 3. This would be additional time and effort for department staff to do. I can't quantify how much or how that would fit into the process right now. Currently, districts, except for Minneapolis-St. Paul and Duluth, do submit their plans to the state, and then we actually do not approve the plan. We approve the budget. That's our authority, and it's a little unusual. But I'm not. I can't quantify right now, Representative Erickson, you know, what the cost would be. As far as the local costs, there's probably some additional local costs they'd have to add this to the report, but I would allow the organizations to talk about that if they'd like.
Yes, Assistant Commissioner, right now there is a process in the department for the majority of the districts involved, where there's an approval process that involves your individuals and your staff. How, and I know you're just looking at this for the first time, but do you anticipate at this point that this would greatly be different from that sort of deployment of resources and processes that the department's engaged in approving those plans?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, since the legislative audit report that was issued in, I believe, 2003 or 2004, the department has implemented a more rigorous review of those programs and plans. So we would just incorporate that into the process we've developed since that report. It will take additional work for us, but we do have a process in place. We may have to change timelines for when we receive reports because we may need additional time to review 1, 2, and 3, which would be required, and that would be something we'd have to take a look at. I can't speak to with definiteness right now.
I saw some hands up on this, Representative Demers.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner Anderson just reminded me that we don't have reporting and we don't have the necessity for any kind of request or a plan from Duluth, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. Would this amendment then apply to them also? And to keep getting revenue, would they also be submitting a plan for how to show how they're progressing and that sort of thing, Mr. Chair?
Representative Demmer, it's my intention that all districts would comply with that. Any other questions or comments? If not, all in favor of the 816 amendments, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Next amendment is the A11 amendment. That's my amendment. I will move that amendment. And then I'll ask Mary Gilbert from St. Paul Schools to come and explain the amendment. Ms. Gilbert.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. We're talking about basketball this morning. I'd like to say that my son's team, South, is also in the tournament and won yesterday as well, and they're playing at noon today.
Congratulations.
So go Tigers.
Go Tigers.
The temporary closing amendment is a result of some disagreement between very smart attorneys about what really triggers a school closing law. Some district attorneys think that if you close the building for any reason and it doesn't operate as a public school, that it would trigger the school closing laws. Others sometimes lay the building over, use it for other purposes, sometimes lease it out, and before they actually sell the building or shutter the building as a school property, then you go through the closing law. As you know or have read in the paper, we're dealing with programmatic changes in St. Paul, and we are having a conversation with our community about how to keep our buildings open as schools. And what this amendment simply does is give any district who wants to have that conversation with the community about what to do and how to repurpose the school and maintain it as a schoolhouse a little bit of time, so that the community isn't confused that we're having a conversation on one hand about what to do with the school and on the other hand having a hearing to close the school. It makes the community not very trustful about the process if we're doing both things simultaneously.
Are there any questions? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. Our school district is going through some school closings as well, and have that. Ms. Gilbert has also had this dialogue, and I totally support this. This is a great amendment, and thank you for bringing it forward.
Any further questions or comments? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Do we foresee any unintended consequences from what I think would be rather precedent-setting in policy?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Peterson, the amendment...
Peterson.
Can you call
it? Oh, you lost your
both
there.
Yes.
I ran into some of the people from Rochester yesterday, and they were smiling, and I said it was pretty clear that they obviously didn't work at the Capitol this week. the provision still requires that the board have a public hearing and provide the opportunity for public input. And if any of you have noticed what's going on in our process, we have had multiple public hearings to make sure that the community is included in the discussion. Thank you.
Any further comments, questions? If not, I renew our motion that the A11 amendment be adopted. Oh, boy. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Next is, Ms. Gilbert, you might want to stay up there. Next is the A3 amendment. That's my amendment. I will move that amendment. Ms. Gilbert, if you will.
Good morning again, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools. This issue has just come up recently regarding a piece of legislation that the advocacy group and the district negotiated several years ago. And it has, and it needs some clarification, and we've been working with the department, and I've worked with NAMI, just to clarify that a district, A, would like to be notified when a child is placed in care and treatment. We're responsible for providing the educational services while that child is in care and treatment, and if we don't know where they are, it's difficult for us to work with the family, so that we can tell them where we have teachers, where we have curriculum, where we have, and where we provide transportation. And it also puts in, it clarifies the district have to provide reasonable transportation when somebody other than the district makes the placement. If we're not involved in the placement and we don't know about it, what's happened is we've had some requests after the fact to provide transportation for out of district care and treatment facility. So this is just clarifying that, and it's kind of reiterating that we would really like the courts to let us know, too. Again, these kids are the kids that we really want to keep track of because they're struggling in school, and it just is to increase the communication between the two and to kind of clarify what the practice has been. But it's, the department has had to kind of do this on a case-by-case basis, and it's just making it clear in law what it is.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has the advocacy group agreed to this language? Mr. Chairman and Representative Erickson. I met with NAMI and I also met with Pacer, and we were both actually. I felt less crazy because we didn't think when we negotiated it that it would be as broad as it is. And so that's why we both agreed that it had gotten a little carried away with some of the requests that we were having from people who had placed their children in treatment. And Mr. Chair?
Representative Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is not just a problem in St. Paul or Minneapolis. We have these issues also in rural Minnesota, so I would hope that something like this could be beneficial in our situations as well.
Ms. Gilbert.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what this is intended to do, to allow for a reasonable test to be applied when a child is placed by somebody other than the district. And
very well. Any other comments from the audience? Any questions? If not, then I renew my motion to adopt the A3 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Do we have any other amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chair. 1368.
Representative Slawick moves the 1368 amendment. Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the 1368 amendment. Actually, again, Representative Bly asked me to look at this language. I'd like him to talk about it.
Representative Bly.
Chairman Mariani. This provision seeks to amend current law, which allows for site-based decision-making in a program within a school district. Currently, Maybe I can give a little bit of history. In my own experience as a lead teacher in an alternative school, when we had good relationships with a superintendent and other district folks, it was easy to design the program and create a program that you believe best served the students that you worked with. When superintendent may change and district philosophy may change, it creates a difficulty for the school to continue in the program in the style and philosophy in which it existed if the superintendent or the board determines that they would like it to become more traditional. What this was intended to do was to allow for the program to establish what they wanted to be like, how the kind of education they wanted to deliver to the students, and primarily, I think, affect most alternative programs. What we would like to do, it allows for this to happen, but we would like to, if the board should decline the plan that's presented, allow for an appeal process so that either party, the board or the program, could appeal to the commissioner on the ruling. That's the one change that this would make. I have heard from program directors that they continually get their plans turned down, and we would like to protect the ability for alternative programs to define how they serve the students that they work with. Now, I'd be happy to take questions.
Questions? Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bly, is the intent here to say that the commissioner could overrule the school board in their decision, or a rule that they have to come to agreement if they fail? Is that the intent?
Representative Bly.
Certainly to have that possibility, yes. I think that I think the commissioner would decide whether it's what would be the best tack to take, whether they ought to overturn or whether they ought to get the two parties to talk a little further. I think the concern that we have is that even though the law does say reasons have to be given explaining why a plan is rejected, sometimes that it could be arbitrary. And even though you can say you have reasons, we want to make sure that the necessity of having a different kind of approach is presented.
Mr. Chair, I would have to oppose this. We have a locally elected school board, and working with their bargaining unit, this is local decisions, and with all due respect to the commissioner, I don't see that he or she would be entering in and overruling these locally locally designated people that are negotiating this sort of thing. So I just respectfully think this is a bad idea.
Ms. Schwab.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Grace Schwab, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. I ask you to turn to the first page of the amendment under D. You'll look at all this agreement that the commission would rule on would have to include in it, and it really has to be agreed by both sides of the dime. And if you look at F at the stricken language, the school board has to provide a copy of the request and reasons for denial to the commissioner. This would, in effect, make the commissioner make those decisions and be able to overrule one side or the other, clearly as it went forward. We've got real concerns about this. I think if we're having trouble with alternative schools, maybe we need to find a place in law to fix it. I mean, this is site-based decision-making schools that could definitely, I don't want to question Representative Bly's intentions here, but we could deal with that in another section of law instead of one that we use for lots of other purposes.
Representative Slawick, I think there's empathy here for what Representative Bly has brought forward. I've had conversations with Representative Bly, but there are some other principles, unfortunately, that this raises, and I share Representative Demmer's concern about sort of authority lines between locally elected school boards and the commissioner. So I am a little nervous about this. We can certainly take a vote on this. I really want to move quickly here.
But I leave it to you, Representative Blau, with Representative Blau.
Mr. Chair, I think I'll withdraw the amendment. We wanted to Representative Blau, obviously this is a very important issue to him, so Ms. Schwab, if you could work with him in the short term or during the interim and try to work out something that maybe both sides could agree with. And so, Mr. Chair, I withdraw the 1368 amendment.
Very well. The amendment is withdrawn. Members, there are no other amendments before us. The motion then is to recommend that House File 15 as amended be recommended to pass, and this is going to the General Register. Any discussion? If not, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Members, I'm going to ask your wisdom here. We have one bill. We can come back at 6 o'clock, or we can spend 15 minutes now, and maybe I can go home and get better. Let's do it. Representative Dabney. Representative Dabney moves that House File 3469 be recommended to pass. Where are we going? And this will be going to transportation policy, is that correct, Representative Dabney?
That's my understanding, yes.
Very well. Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much for the opportunity to present House File 3469 to you today. I'd like to move the DE2 amendment, if I could.
Representative Dabney moves the DE2 amendment, a delete everything amendment. All
and,
in favor?
Mr. Chair, I have an oral amendment to the DE2 amendment.
We'll incorporate that in your amendment, then.
On page 2, line 11, after the word service, insert a period and strike at the direction of the local school district. This assures that both private bus vendors and public bus transportation providers are treated equally under the language there.
Very well, members. Do you understand the amendment on line 211? Insert a... Ms. Parsons?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, did you intend that to be the end of a sentence, or did you intend that to be the end of a clause? Because if you intend it to be an end of a clause, you'll need to insert a semicolon, or actually just leave the semicolon on 212.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Larson, grammar was never my strong suit.
Let me get that on record.
Mr. Chair, I'm at the disposal of Ms. Larson. Whatever she recommends.
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, I'm assuming that you intend Clause 6 to remain in the list of 7 clauses, and so that you simply need to delete the language on page 2, lines 11 and 12, at the direction of the local school district. Is that correct?
Representative Dabney.
That's correct.
So, Representative Dabney, we'll incorporate that into your DE2 amendment. Members all in favor of the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, House File 3469 is a significant compromise over legislation that I introduced last year, House File 2024, in response to ongoing concerns about bus safety for students here in Minnesota. This committee spends a lot of its time focused on the school day, what goes on, and how well our students are doing during the school day. With this bill, I ask you to start instead with our first responsibility in the morning and our last responsibility at night, and that's the safe transportation of Minnesota students to and from school. Earlier this in January, the legislative auditor released a report on student transportation that magnified my concerns about the challenges school districts and school boards experience, whether they're providing the service or whether they choose to contract out for that service. I've asked the page to pass out to the executive summary. The OLA found school districts that had no written contract with their bus provider, or districts that had a one-page contract that merely listed the payment rates with no performance expectations whatsoever. Districts that didn't follow state statute on assuring that drivers were tested annually on drug and alcohol tests, or that the private vendors that they used were testing and reporting the results to the school district. school districts or private vendors that were not assuring the district and the parents that the school bus drivers were licensed school bus drivers. And they found that many school districts were confused about their responsibilities and roles, whether they were the provider of the transportation or whether they contracted out that responsibility. Fundamentally, the responsibility for safe student transportation begins and remains with the school district, whether they contract out or retain those services. What House File 3469 does is assures parents that the primary responsibility for their child's school bus safety remains with the district, whether the district performs those services themselves or contracts out, and stipulates that areas of concern for student safety that the school district must discuss and document with the private contractor if they choose that route and negotiate as part of its contract. The stipulated items help to assure parents that adults driving their children's bus are well qualified, well trained, and continuously retrained, are screened for compliance with state and federal safety requirements, are stable employees, and the public has a right to know of records of traffic accidents and applicable traffic convictions, and the school transportation contracts are awarded in light of both student safety and cost effectiveness. Lastly, HS 3469 assures students and families that the bus their child rides on is inspected every day by the driver, and that if it is not a safe vehicle to drive, that the driver has the right to refuse the vehicle in the interest of student safety. Mr. Chair, with me today is Ms. Kim Nelson from the Service Employees International Union.
Ms. Nelson, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Mariani, members of the committee. My name is Kim Nelson. I'm the political director at SEIU Local 284. We would be the public division of SEIU. SEIU represents just under 30,000 people throughout the state. 284 represents 8,500 school employees. They'd be your food service workers, custodians, clerical folks, paraprofessionals, and bus drivers. We have a number of interests in why we pursue the issue of student transportation so diligently. First and foremost, we represent bus drivers who view themselves as professionals, and they want to make sure that the standards within their industry are maintained at a certain level. Secondly, because we do represent other school employees, when you look at student transportation, it's one of the big spending areas our school districts have. It's one of the top expenditure areas. And if the dollars there are not spent in the most cost-effective way for the quality of service, then unfortunately it's usually our food service workers and custodians that are the first to be laid off. So we have a number of reasons that we're involved in this issue. I want to thank Representative Gaffney here for leading the charge, and I'd also like to thank the work that was done in the interim with various agencies and the industry. As Representative Gavin stated, this is compromised language. This is vastly different from our bill last year. We accepted language that Minnesota Association of Pupil Transporters offered to us. We reviewed it, and we're okay with that language. Basically, at this point, this bill is focusing on the 45% of districts that currently contract out over 50%. It lays out the types of items that school boards should be looking at during the bidding cycle with their student transportation contractors. We know that 97% of parents that we interviewed stated that this type of information should be gathered by school boards before public funds are spent. So with that, I'll just be here if there's any questions.
Thank you. We're obviously rushing because we're over our time here. There are individuals that have come, traveled to testify. I want to make sure we hear from them, and then we have some questions, and then we'll try to get to a vote here, Representative Abney.
Thank you.
So is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify? Now would be the time. And I'm going to ask you to be very concise, because we are over time in our committee at this point. We also need to get to the floor by chat. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Galen Lenz. I own Lake Crystal School Bus Service in Lake Crystal. I'm also a member of the MSBOA, the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. We have several members over here right now. We came to testify against this bill, and I'd like to state some of our reasons. First of all, in the end result, what does this bill accomplish? And we feel that right now this bill would not accomplish anything significant. It would not significantly increase student transportation safety, and it would not include efficiency. What this bill is asking for, as I'm going down through this, a lot of this, what's in here, is already in state statute, whether it's with the Department of Public Education or Department of Public Safety. It also is in a lot of standard contracts, and if it is not in a lot of standard contracts, like the Legislative Auditor's Report said, the Auditor's Report has recommended that the Department of Education provide a model contract to all districts, and they are working on that at this moment. So we believe that this bill would be redundant to something that would take out of the control of local school boards and the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Education. This bill also, as I go down through it, some of the other things that are also in here would impede upon private companies and their employees and what should be kept private, like wage scales and benefits, to where we try and retain our drivers as we compete with the rest of the working sector. Also, the driver right to refuse, I'd like to touch on that real quick. I don't know of any bus operator that would make a driver drive a bus that is unsafe. But the right to refuse immediately, we feel that they'd also have to talk with the shop mechanic or the owner of the company to make sure it is unsafe and make sure that they understand state statute and what is a safe bus and what is not. An example given, if a driver figures that, well, I believe the front tread of this tire is too low, you know, the state says that you can drive on a minimum slow 30 seconds, and it could be 6:30 seconds, so you've got to be able to talk about that first before that driver just refuses to drive that bus. Now, over time, the SEIU and the Honorable Rep right here has implied that any school districts that privately or that contract their operations out is for some reason less safe than any district that keeps it in-house. I believe the SEIU did their own study with the Minneapolis school district, and what they found is that two-thirds of all the bus accidents in Minneapolis occurred in contractor-owned buses, while one-third occurred in buses that were owned by in-house. So what the study also failed to mention was that two-thirds of the buses in that operation were contracted out and one-third are owned by in-house. So the data is the same, the data to accident ratio. Also, the State Auditor's Report has also brought forward that there are a lot of school districts also that have not implemented drug and alcohol testing programs. And in that auditor's report, that's often the public school districts side that own their own. None of us were asked to contribute to this report, so none of our information was included in it. I believe if you have any questions whether contracted buses are any safer or less safe than what is in-house, I believe the people you need to ask is Captain Ken Urquhart of the Minnesota State Patrol and the State Inspectors. I believe he will tell you that contracted buses are just as safe, if not safer, because that is our only business. We must do it well, and we must do it safely, or we are out of business, and our lives are ruined. We need to do it well. We work with the local school boards on that. And this bill targets nothing but contractors. It does not target the districts that own the school buses on their own. Also, it talks about driver pay in here. First of all, federal regulations that govern what drivers' wages, that they be fairly reimbursed and have good working conditions. One thing I'd like to point out in the state of Minnesota, that driving a school bus is still considered a part-time seasonable job. I would love to be able to give my drivers 8 hours a day, $25 an hour, but the money is not there. The state reimburses to the local districts as a part-time seasonal job, and the money is not there. So for a lot of districts, drivers drive an hour in the morning, an hour in the afternoon, and there is no more. A couple of tools that the state took away from the local districts in the past have been also they took the dedicated transportation fund and they moved it into the general fund so it can be used elsewhere to take away from transportation and the safety programs. It also took away the school district's right to be able to use an excess levy, the levy, locally, 100% for things like hazardous transportation. So those tools are taken away. Yet every year, as contractors, we work with the local districts. We work with the school boards who have local control. And we hammer out the best program available. And they'll say, what can we do to stay within this budget? Because they know the monies that they have. And we sit down and we go through that every year. We reevaluate the routes. We reevaluate where we can cut because over the years, districts have been cutting. They have not been expanding on this stuff. So we have worked with them. So we're urging you to vote right now, vote no on this bill. We ask that you not vote yes out of fear of the unknown because if you have any questions about the school bus industry, we have not been included in this discussion. If you have any questions, we'd be glad to sit down with you anytime, anywhere, and try and get you the right answers because this is something we live every day, 24/7. This is our future. This is what many of us have done for 30, 40 years. And we believe that this is something that would attack private industry, but we still do it well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lance. I appreciate your thoroughness and the passion that you bring to this issue. Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair and members, there certainly is no implication on my part that districts that contract out are choosing a less safe alternative. It's simply a question of whose responsibility is it. The responsibility for safe student transportation remains with the public school board. They can choose to contract out. They can provide that in-house. They can do, as the gentleman indicated, my own district has a combination of the two. But if they're going to contract out, they need to maintain that responsibility for those children and have performance standards in the contract. And that's all this does. As the gentleman indicated, these are our standard expectations, and I believe that they're appropriate then to have in whether it's in the contract or in another document, because the language of the statute or the language of the bill is flexible on how the district discusses these with the providers. And lastly, to his concern about drivers' ability to refuse to drive unsafe buses, you'll note on page 2, line 25, it does stipulate that those concerns need to meet the out-of-service rules and Minnesota rule.
Members, we are due on the House floor in 10 minutes. We have five individuals that have questions, and I think others that may want to testify. It would be the desire of this chair to take a vote in the next couple of minutes. If the vote is successful, the bill will move on to Transportation Policy Committee, where a number of the transportation issues can be further vetted, and that's what I would encourage members to do if it's the will of this committee to pass this bill forward. So, do members, are you okay with Representative Demmer?
Yes, very short.
Very short?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I agree with the testifier 100%. That this is very, very much over the top as far as I'm concerned for school boards. Knowing details about a contractor's employees, how they're retained, how you retain them, how they're paid, what their background is of individual employees in terms of suitability. We have licensing requirements for people driving school buses, and I think they meet their licensing requirements. If we don't think those licensing requirements are strong enough, we should address it that way. So I just urge a no vote on this, Mr. Chair, and I do request a roll call also.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Brown.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And testifier, my question in that subsection 2 where the right of refuse was talked about, does this in any way change the driver's liability, I guess? Are we turning him into an inspector or a mechanic by in that section at all? Should there be an accident that is actually a maintenance safety issue? I was concerned about that.
That is something I can't answer because the state requires that the bus be inspected either by the school bus driver or by an individual by the company. As of right now, what is on state statute is that a school bus is inspected at least once a day, and like I said, it can be signed either by a designated individual of the company or by the driver.
so I couldn't answer them.
Representative Ward, Representative Erdoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a real quick comment. I was contacted by, in my legislative district, that has two school districts, both contracts out, and their concern is that the cost of this is going to be, may increase the cost of transportation that the school district can't bear. And we know how strapped we are with finances already, and so that's a real concern in my school district. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have serious concerns about this bill as well, but I would like to donate my 30 seconds here to Mr. Hicks.
If it's 30 seconds, I'm going for a vote here, though, members, if that's okay. Mr. Hicks?
My name is Lyle Hicks. I'm a school bus contractor. I happen to be a Mr. Representative Erdahl's district. I have just two questions very briefly. One is with the requirement to divulge or report all the wages, et cetera. These are private individuals. They're not school employees. They're not government employees. I would expect that if they do this, it would be like asking the people who provide the milk and cheese and all of those other contracts to provide that data for their employees. I understand there's safety involved here, but I don't understand the correlation, and then as well the right to refuse. I have some real issues with that, where there's no requirement to discuss here. The driver has the last right of refusal, and they may mistakenly place a bus out of service that could ultimately leave kids standing by the side of the road waiting while other buses are prepared to go out on the road. So just the technical aspect of how that's in this bill is troubling for me. Thank you very much.
Representative Welty.
Just quickly, Representative Dabney, do you know, is the district currently working on putting together a standard contract that would be used? Or, excuse me, the Department of Education. Is the Department of Education currently working on a standard contract?
Representative Dabney.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Members, the roll call has been called, I'll file my number here. 3469 as amended. The clerk will take the roll on the motion.
Mariani?
Yes.
Dietrich, not here. Abler, not here. Benson?
Yes.
Pardon?
Yes.
Yes. Brown?
No.
Dabney?
Yes.
Zimmer?
No.
Detmer?
No.
Erickson?
No.
Scott Waltz? Not here. Greiling?
Yes.
Heidegen? Not here. Hornstein?
Yes.
Haas? Not here. Lane?
Yes.
Norness?
No.
Peterson?
Yes.
Flowers?
Yes.
Slocum?
Yes.
Swales?
Yes.
Tilbury?
Yes.
Erdahl?
Back in the fold, no.
Ward?
No.
Wardlow?
No.
Welty?
No.
Benson?
Yes.
Yeah.
On a vote of 11 ayes and 9 nays, the motion does prevail. So ordered.
Thank you, Chair and members.
Members, we are adjourned until Friday at 1 p.m. Thank you for your patience today.